Angie's List is now Angie, the nation's largest home services marketplace. And Angie is here to help homeowners get all their jobs done well. Angie has helped over 150 million homeowners care for their homes. Whatever your home project, big or small, indoor or outdoor, come to Angie to connect with and hire skilled professionals to get the job done well. My son needed a major yard cleanup at his new home. We went straight to the Angie website and found a bunch of local, reliable, and affordable pros to handle the job, and one did pronto. Angie can help you find the best price for your project. Angie lets you request and compare quotes from multiple pros in just a few taps, or book services at an upfront price based on local data. Angie has cost guides that tell you what others have paid for similar projects, both nationally and in your area. Get started at Angie.com. That's ANGI.com, or download the app today. The app and website are free to use.
Hello and welcome to the Victor Davis Hanson Show. Victor is the Martin and Neely Anderson Senior Fellow in Military History and Classics at the Hoover Institution and the Wayne and Marsha Buskey Distinguished Fellow in History at Hillsdale College. This is our Saturday edition, and we will look at Greek lyric poetry, and it follows on Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, so the epic poems. So we will engage in that in our second segment of this. But first, we'll look at some news, and we have U.S. munition shortages on deck, and also immigration and the immigration issue. So stay with us, and we'll be right back.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome back to Victor Davis Hanson Show. You can find Victor at his website, victorhanson.com, and you can come join us for $5 a month or $50 a year. And we welcome one and all to The Blade of Perseus is the name of the website. Well, Victor, I was reading about the munition shortages in the United States due to the fact that we're giving so many arms out for the war in Ukraine and aiding Israel with Gaza to some extent. I know that Israel's relatively independent, but
no, it's not.
70% of its munitions have to come from the United States.
Wow.
Why? Because they have become very, very, not that they are not sophisticated in their own domestic production, but the Iron Dome is a joint project, and much of the resupply of the missiles come from the United States. Mm. Almost all of their fighters now come from the United States, the parts,
yeah,
everything.
Yeah.
The artillery shell, all of that comes from it, because they're facing a worldwide, I don't know, the arms people are not willing to sell to them on a strictly free market basis, and they're very expensive, and the United States gives them over $2 or $3 billion in arms sales,
yeah,
and basically aid a year. So they need us.
Yeah. Well, the article went further than just that, and they were looking at China and China's, you know, provocations with Taiwan, with elections coming up in Taiwan, and that Xi has promised reunification, which is no promise at all. But the article looked at China's control of 65% of rare earth minerals that are used in munitions. And I thought that was kind of interesting that the United States needs to be very careful because the Chinese are well endowed for making munitions, whereas the United States is not quite so well endowed. So we need to focus on our ability to assume those munitions. And I was wondering your thoughts on that predicament.
Well,
I'm sorry, I assume the rare earth materials is what we need to be focused on, not the munitions. Well, to make the munitions, but go ahead.
I mean, I don't know all the names of them. I remember scandium and lanthanides and things like that, and yttrium. But the point is, all of these things, if we had a Marshall Plan to scour them out, and some of them we know exist, lithium and all that stuff, in huge amounts in the United States. I mean, the area of the United States is roughly equivalent to China's, but we're not looking. This administration is not trying. It finally has broken down, I think, and admitted that for EV batteries are willing to look at lithium and stuff, but we have those materials here. And the second thing is, most of these weapon systems, whether it's sophisticated tanks or missiles or ships, the designs, the technology, they started in Europe or the United States or Japan. And so it's a Western monopoly. What I'm getting at is, we have the ability. We have the technology. We have the supremacy in design. We have the wherewithal as far as labor. We have everything, but we don't have the willpower. And then we do certain things that are so stupid, and we just think we're the United States, that it won't hurt us, such as leaving behind $50 billion, maybe it's more, of weapons in Afghanistan, small arms, machine guns, drones, everything. We just left it there. And then we look at this defense budget, and you look at the $700 billion. I mean, you look at overhead pensions, DEI programs. How many artillery shells could you get for firing all the DEI woke overseers in the Pentagon? A lot. So it's not that we don't have the money, and it's not that we don't have the minerals, and it's not we don't have the know-how. We have all of that. We just don't have willpower. Like, part of it's the left. They feel that we shouldn't be producing weapons except for Ukraine. As I said before, one of the funniest things, I used to ride my bike around the Stanford campus, right, even as a way of getting over long COVID. And I just remember all the signs that during the George Floyd said, "This house does not support racism." This, how all of a sudden it was a Ukrainian flag. We may be left-wing, and we may root out all hatred, and we're trying to war against the MAGA extremists, but you got to get a lot more Patriot batteries and shells and get them over to Ukraine so they can kill those damn Ruskies. That was the attitude. And so I think maybe the left wants us to rearm a little bit to help Ukraine, but other than that, they've been against rearming.
Yeah.
It's a very dangerous world now, and I think everybody should realize that, as I said in the last podcast, deterrence will prevent war. So what we need to do is have more ships and more planes and more drones and more munitions than any other country in the world by far, and just sit there and say, "Don't screw with us," and we won't have a war.
Yeah.
But when we start poking our nose all over the world and lecturing people and flying pride flags on our embassy in Afghanistan as we flee, are giving lectures about the spring offensive is going to go on to Moscow, and when you know it can't, or you start telling Israel not to do this and not to do that, or you send these two big carriers in the Mediterranean, the moment one starts to leave, Iran just sneaks in and says, you know, it's our Mediterranean, then you got real problems. And we've lost deterrence. We're short military personnel in all branches of the service. We've got enormous overhead of audit, administration, DEI, all of that. We've alienated from service those who did not get vaccinated that were fired. We basically told those who died at 75% in Iraq and Afghanistan that you're guilty of white rage and white supremacy and we don't want you. And now we learn that when Mark Milley and Lloyd Austin went to Congress 2 years and said, I'm going to understand Professor Kendi. I've got to understand him. Well, there was nothing to understand, Mark Milley. He just said that you can be a racist, it's okay to stop racism, meaning me and Ibrahim Kendi can call people white blank, blank, blank because they're racist. That's all it was a binary. But nevertheless, he said he was going to study it and they were going to run an investigation. Guess what? This month they had the investigation conclusion. They couldn't find any cabal, conspiracy, core, militia groups inside the military. They didn't exist. So did they issue an apology and say, we're sorry, we defamed all the white working class males? No. But they did lose them. And if you talk, as I keep saying, you talk to military people of a high rank, oh no, Victor, that's just a right-wing talking point. Our boys are too fat. They're covered with tats. They're drug addicts. We have to compete against the private sector with three important... No. You start winning again, you have a competent military, you reward battlefield efficacy and competency, and you are racially blind and gender blind, and you don't start this way, you'll get them to come back.
Yeah. Well, let's turn then to immigration, and it seems like there's the migrant wars going on. We have on the one hand Karine Jean-Pierre saying that it's shameful that Texas is sending migrants to northern cities. She seems a day late and a dollar short with that assessment, but she recently said that. And a Democratic mayor in New Jersey who has sent a bus full of asylum seekers back to the Texas border, and the left is really got in its migrant wars, illegal immigrant wars.
It's really funny because when Texas started sending busloads of illegal immigrants into big northern cities or Florida or whatever particular red state, they started getting so angry and they said, this is illegal. As if letting them in on the border was fine as long as they stayed down there. So for me, it was very hard to understand the left-wing blue city Eric Adams type of mayor's calculus that was fine with open borders. And remember the first boat, the very first busload, he met them. As they got off the bus, he handed them a little bottle of water. Happy to be here. We're a sanctuary city. That lasted about two busloads. But what was the attitude about? I guess the attitude was one of two things, or both. The first one was, well, we don't like red states, so we're just going to let 10 million, we're going to let them in and let them deal with it, right?
Yeah.
And we're just going to let them deal with it. We think this is great. And two, I guess they thought, we're for this and we're for this in theory, but we don't like these people. So we don't want them here. So we want to punish the red states with more costs for anybody, but we particularly don't want anybody from the south of the border coming. So what else could it be that they were so angry that when people south of the border started to leave red states, was it because they thought, wow, we didn't raise taxes enough, we didn't break their budgets enough, we didn't get them angry enough? Or was it, oh my God, all these brown people are coming to Martha's Vineyard and they're going to crap on my lawn and they're going to sleep out in the street, they're going to smoke dope, they're going to oogle and whistle at my daughter. We can't have these people here. I don't know what it was, but it was one of those two.
It's hard to make a choice. Well,
by the way, I was walking this morning, my little illegal immigration. It's Christmas, so what was I expecting to see? I thought, on my morning walk around the farm, it's Christmas, and I expect to see somebody throw their Christmas tree out in the almond orchard. And I was exactly so happy when I saw one. And it was frosted, too. It had frosting on it, white frosting. They just said, you know what? There's a stupid old white guy out there who's old and should go find someplace and die. But until he does, I'm going to take my Christmas tree out of my living room. I'm not going to cut it up and put it in the trash can or take it to the dump. I'm just going to go put it in the car and go out and maybe, I don't know, late in the afternoon, just dump it. And that's what they did. And they have a lot of trash around it. Being Sherlock Holmes, I went out and looked at the trash. And I did not find, guess what, one incriminating address. Not one power bill, not one phone bill, not one advertising. But I did find almost everything in Spanish.
Wow.
So that's what I said. I brought that up in connection with illegal immigration.
Yeah.
And by the way, it's not people here who are second and third generation Mexican-American people who are doing that. It's people coming right across the border. And when I drive down, if I go one quarter from my house and I make a left or right turn down, I won't mention the boulevard. It looks like a trash heap. That I grew up with that boulevard, avenue, whatever we call it, my entire life. I used to walk down, I used to ride a bike. It was never like this. No sooner do the farmers clear out the crap that within hours, I'm not kidding you, hours, there are washing machines, beds, mattresses, car seats, junk, every weight. I saw a workout platform there, and they just throw them out there and no one says a word.
Well, Victor, the last thing I want to talk about before we turn to Greek lyric poets is that in USA Today, which is a fairly left-wing publication, they had a story about how blacks, Hispanics, and young voters are abandoning Biden. And their poll was the Roper Center poll. And it showed that black support dropped from 87% in 2020 to 63% today. And Hispanics prefer Trump to Biden 39% to 34%. And young voters, again, 37 to 33. But I thought what was even more interesting in that article was that the happy columnist says that much has gone to the third party candidates. And he mentioned in particular RFK Jr., who has got lots of those votes. At least that was the suggestion. He didn't say exactly what he
but. Well, it's very hard to know whether, I guess he was let on the Utah ballot lately, but they're going to try to keep him off. They're going to try to keep Jill Stein off. They're going to try to keep Representative Phillips off. They're going to try to keep Cornel West off. Add them all up, one here, two there, three there, percent, and you may get up to 15%, and you can be in Ross Perot territory. What happened to George H.W. Bush, and we know just what Ralph Nader did to Al Gore in Florida in 2000. So they are paranoid about third-party candidates. And so that's one thing to remember. But I just don't believe those polls.
Yeah, you do.
Because if Trump got 35% of the black vote, or he got 50% of the Hispanic vote, it wouldn't just be a tsunami that would wipe out Joe Biden. But you wouldn't get any House member in any purple state or senator elected because the down ballot. I just don't believe that's going to happen. I don't think that. I was wrong in the midterms. I thought the Republicans would pick up 20 seats and they might pick up the Senate. And then the abortion thing happened after I said that. But I just don't think they're going to. I would like them to pick up 40 seats, and I would like them to pick up 10 Senate seats. And to do that, those numbers would ensure that if they're accurate. But I don't think they are. I just don't think so. And what are we talking about? What's the subtext of this whole conversation? That anything, as far as the African-American vote, anything over 12 to 15%, in the case of Latino, which is now a larger vote, anything over 45%, it's history for the Democratic candidate because they have completely turned off the white working class, and that's 33% of the population. And I'm talking about, margins of 70-75% vote against the left. And so they need these minority votes at astronomical, asymmetrical majorities. And if they don't get them, they're done. So I just don't think that's going to happen. I really don't. And this is all before the campaign. So remember what's going to happen come January, February, March, April, when the Republican nominee is finalized. If it's Trump, and it looks like it probably will be, they're going to unleash lawfare round two. And they're going to have leaks from the judge, the prosecutor. He's really guilty of this. He said this. Just, they're going to saturate the media with it. They're going to tie him up in court. They're going to give him gag orders. And then they're going to unleash their Zuckerberg bucks, or whatever we want to call it. Hundreds of millions of dollars on voting protocols. But more, they're going to unleash publicity. They're going to run on three things. Abortion. Donald Trump is Donald Trump. Satanic, Hitlerite. And insurrection, MAGA. Super mega, hyper mega insurrection. That's all they're going to run. They're not going to mention a word. They'll talk about Bidenomics, but they won't talk about it in the election cycle. Not unless, you know, there's a huge deflation and we somehow get back to 2021 prices when he came into office. He's raised them by 30% on things that count. And they're not going to talk about the border. And they're not going to talk about crime. And they're not going to talk about foreign policy. And they're not going to talk about energy.
That's a lot of not talks about.
They're going to talk about
they can't talk
insurrection
about
January 6th, insurrection January 6th. Trump did this, Trump said this, Trump tweeted this, Trump's this, Trump's this, right?
Yeah.
And they're going to talk about they want to kill you. They want to make sure that, you know, every single woman is going to be pregnant in the United States, and she's going to be told if she doesn't get an abortion, she'll die tomorrow, and yet they killed her. That's how it'll be framed. Okay. And the Republicans walked right into it. They really did. They weren't smart about abortion.
Yeah. Well, Victor, let's take a break and then come back and talk about Greek lyric poets. Stay with us and we'll be back.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
We're back. This is the Victor Davis Hanson Show, and this is the Saturday edition, so we look at something cultural. And following the epic poems of Homer are the Greek lyric poets, many of whom lived in the 6th century BC, and so a little bit before the classical era of ancient Athens. So an older poetry, but definitely no less rich in its discussion of human affairs and the human condition. So, Victor, I'm anxious to hear about these lyric poets. Go ahead.
Well, we talked about, so far, Homer, who wrote around 700, composed, I should say, the Odyssey and the Iliad. Those are epic poems. They're written around 12,000 lines. They're very long poems. They're written in dactylic hexameter. And that's like your dactyl, your finger. Long, short, short, six times. They have a beat. Menenade, da-da-da, Polymetis Odysseus, or something like that. But this is different. And Hesiod was wrote in hexameter. These are lyric poems. They're designed to be accompanied by the lyre, L-Y-R-E. It's sort of like a harp. and they have a very different meter. They're light. They're usually an iambic, short, long, short, long, short, long, short, long, short, long. And these are beats, da, 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 five times. Or they can be in elegiac couplets or trochees or anapet. Well, we don't need to get into those, but they have a different sound to them. And the topic is different. It's not about war. It's not about monsters. It's not about heroism. It's about life. Wine, women, sex, beauty, the ocean, flowers. It's like modern poetry. And they're short, very short. And so sometime right at the end of the epic cycle, there's a new genre that coincided with the rise of the city-state. And we started to see, especially off the coast of Asia Minor in the islands, Chios, Lesbos, and in Ione itself, poets, along with the pre-Socratic philosophers, which we're going to talk about maybe next time, a whole body of lyric poetry by people who wrote in very short poems about a very different topic and very different sounding to us meters. And I'll give you an example. One is a very famous one, Archilochus. It's only, one line. I think all of you know it. The fox knows many tricks. The hedgehog, only one good one. Or I think the Greek says one big one. And that was famous for Isaiah Berlin's idea of two types of knowledge or freedom. And we know it as the hedgehog is the guy who knows everything. And the fox knows everything a little bit, and the hedgehog knows one thing, but he knows a lot. And it's that old idea of generic versus specialized knowledge or specialized expertise or skills versus being broadly educated. And Archilochus, there's also an attack on wealthy people, the establishment. In the Iliad and the Odyssey, you have Agamemnon and Menelaus, and you have Achilles criticize it, but he's an aristocrat himself. And Hesiod, you have the first bit of a farmer who's attacking the bribe-swallowing establishment. But lyric is anti-wealth. I mean, in one of Archilochus' poem, he says, "Nothing to me the life of Gyges." Gyges was a proverbial Lydian that was very... "And his glut of gold. I neither envy nor admire him as I watch his life and what he does. I want no pride of tyranny. It lies far off from where I look." Sort of a reaffirmation of the new city-state and the idea of freedom and consensual government. Minermus was a different poem. He had... listen to this one. "What then is life if love the golden is gone? What is pleasure better to die when the thought of these is lost from my heart?" I mean, if you get old and you're not... your testosterone level goes down, then it's bad, because the best thing about being young is, I guess, love and sex. I can remember this poem. I remember I had a course when I was 18, and we were tested on whether you could recite it by memory in Greek. "So what then is life of love? The golden is gone. What is pleasure? Tiste bios tiste terpton ater crus seis aphrodites. What good... what is life, what is pleasure, terpnon, without golden Aphrodite," which is the manifestation of sex. So we have all of these poems. Maybe some of you heard Sappho, where the word lesbian comes from the island of Lesbos, where she reportedly came, because she has a whole series of poems about sex and desire, both male and female, but she was sexually... what's the word, non-binary?
Yes.
And so, and then Alcaeus, he also came from Lesbos. It's a beautiful island if you go there, but Simonides is probably the most famous of all the poets. And "Go tell the Spartans that here we lie, obedient to their words." That is the monument of the 300 that died at Thermopylae. And you can go there today, and the Greek government has that Simonides line there, that little couplet. And I think there was a movie with Burt Lancaster, "Go Tell the Spartans." Go tell it. And so the dead, and that happens in Greek epigrams, and a lot of the epigrams are in elegiac couplets, or lyric poems themselves. Go tell the Spartans, so the dead Spartans who are the 300 are there under the ground, and as you walk by, their little plaque or their monument says, go tell everybody 300 miles to the south that we're still here. They told us no retreat, where we're still here obedient to their remata in the data plural. And so what does lyric poetry do? It's the poetry of commemoration of the dead. It's taking off or a critique of the seriousness of epic poetry. It's mostly about food and sex. And we have, the names of maybe 100 lyric poets. And we have sizable corpuses from maybe 15. And there's Simonides, there's Theognis, there's Alcaeus, there's, Archilochus, there's Solon, the lawgiver. The seven ages of man, he tells us that the average or ideal age to live and die is 1 year. You're born 1 to 10, 10 to 20, 20 to 30, 30, 40, 40, 50, 50, and then you're done at 70. I'd be done.
Wow.
But in each age, there's a fitting way to look at the world, and your activity is based on the maturity of your mind and the resilience of your body. And then at 70, your mind and your body go. It's time to leave. But it's a very different genre. The problem we have with it is it, and we have this with all Greek literature, is remember that these were written on papyrus paper. And it's an oral. I think the poets may have written them down after the 700s. They're no longer the oral tradition. But they were read out loud. And when people heard them, they wanted to read them or have, nobody, what I'm trying to stumble at is that nobody bought a papyrus roll at a bookseller, say in a basket in the Agora at Athens, and came home and like we read by himself. They were very expensive to copy, and the paper was not that durable. So you would buy a corpus of Archilochus's poems, and then you would invite people over to a symposium, a drinking together banquet. You would all recline, you'd eat dinner, and then someone would recite by memory or read a poem. That's how, and same thing with Herodotus or a history. And so what happened was that those had to be copied every couple of 100 years, at least, the papyrus paper. And it's not indigenous to Greece. It has to come from Egypt. It's sort of a reed-like plant. And, you know, to make it, you have to you take the reed and you put them, you cut it and then you smash it and then you smash a lot of them together and you force them into sort of a paper-like quality. And the ones that last are places that in Alexandria are parts of the Roman Empire where it was dry and arid and they did not deteriorate. And if they're not copied, then there's going to be a winnowing out process. And then sometime in the Roman period, in that transitional point period, there was a development of parchment, skins, paper. And that was more durable and gave you 300 or 400 years. But what were the criteria that made some copied and some not? Why was Homer's two poems copied, at least in number, and not the Cypriot itself? Why is Hesiod the only other person that we know at the time whose work written in hexameters around 700 survived? Or why did we have more poems of Sappho but not Archilochus? Part of it's the age, the era. If you're writing in 700, there's less chance it's going to be copied. If you're writing in 450 or 430, when the city-state's in full flourishing. But there is also popularity. And that means whether you like it or not, or whether people like it or not, or whether it's popular. And then when you get into the 5th century AD, 6th century, and these parchments, manuscripts have to be copied every 300 or 400 years. then you start to have a new set of criteria. The Dark Ages are there. Roman civilization has collapsed. Most of the cities don't have libraries anymore, like at Alexandria or Pergamum, and the receptacles of learning are church-related. Sometimes the existence of a manuscript that is contrary to the tenets of Catholicism means it won't be copied in the same amount. If you look at Petronius the Satyricon, a very ribald novel written around, 60 AD in Latin, I think we only have parts of the 14th, 15th, and 16th book, and people have suggested that was the middle of a 24-book novel, and maybe they hid it somewhere, or the first part and the last part were in just one or two copies is all we had, the original, and it kind of rotted away and the middle stayed. People have all sorts of theories why we have just the middle of the novel and a few fragments elsewhere. The other way you can transmit classical literature is on quotations. So if you're reading Plato's Laws or Republic, Socrates will say, just as Archilochus says, and then he will quote something, or Plutarch will, 100 AD, will quote people. Sometimes they quote them quite accurately from what we can tell. And then we have the manuscript tradition that goes from papyrus to parchment, and then it has to make its way all the way to 1500, essentially, when you have Gutenberg and books. If you make it to books, then 95% of classical literature that we have today, they had about 1500, with one exception. There was also a different tradition of survival in the Roman Empire in papyrus. And that means that if you were at Oxyrhynchus, to take one example, a village in, along the Nile. I think Oxyrhynchus means sharp-nosed fish. That's the name of the village. But there was a dump there of people who had old books, papyrus books. They wrote shopping lists on it in the back. They used them just like we do today. And because of the climate and the sand, we have direct text that don't depend on being copied every 200 or 300 years, don't depend on having to make it to parchment, don't depend on having to survive during the Dark Ages or early medieval period, don't have to depend on making it to the onset of books and movable type. They survive as they were written, often in very early, the 2nd century B.C. or 3rd century B.C., and sometimes we have enormous discoveries. Aristotle wrote over 150 constitutions, political essays on constitutions. We only have one, the Constitution of Athens. We have the titles of others, but that survived in papyrus. It was not copied down through the manuscript tradition. It didn't survive that way. That was lost. And then somebody in the early 20th, late 19th century found it. Constitution of Athens in a papyrus. Same thing with a long, very explicit sex poem by Archilochus. That survived in papyrus. And every year they find scraps. There's a whole collection of Oxyrhynchus papyrus, but they find scraps they put together and they can assemble new poems and stuff. Will we ever find something that didn't survive in the manuscript? There's only two chances. One is a new find of papyrus, where it's intact. It's, you know, it can be tucked in a pot or some type of box that was buried. Or we have something called palimpsests, and those are manuscripts that are written on top of each other, or they were erased, and then they wrote on top of the other one. So you've got a book. Very expensive to get parchment paper, say 800 or 900 or 1,000 or 100. And so people often just scraped off what they bought and then they copied another author maybe. Or the author's publisher used paper. And with sophisticated techniques of X-ray, you can see a text underneath that one. And so sometimes we get entire new views, and then every once in a while you see something like Pompeii or Herculaneum, where a rich Roman entire house was consumed in a matter of seconds by volcanic ash. He had a library. The library had some pots or vegetables that would preserve his library. He maybe stuck three papyrus rolls inside a clay jar, put the lid on, and we have Stoic philosopher that we didn't know about. And that happens a lot, once in a while. I shouldn't say a lot, but it's happened. And so I think that if we looked at the corpus of all Greek literature, say, in 1850, we've added 2 or 3% to it since then. But some of them have been very dramatic. And everybody wants, of course, you know what they want. There's only 7 plays of Aeschylus. He wrote over 90. There's only 7 plays of Sophocles. He probably wrote even more, 110 or 20. We only have 19 plays of Euripides. We know he wrote over 100. We have 11 plays of Aristophanes. He wrote probably 100 comedies. We have all of Thucydides, but he finished in mid-sentence at 411. He never finished the history. I don't think we'll find that. I think he never completed it. We have all of Herodotus. We have all Xenophon. But we're missing a lot of Aristotle, unfortunately. And we're missing most of, I think, the corpus of Greek lyric poetry. And maybe we'll find something. We have the names of probably over 1,000 Greek authors, poets, historians, philosophers, rhetoricians. We know their names. They're referenced in other literature. We have fragments of their work. We have whole compendia of 19th century scholarship, early 20th century, fragments of Greek history, fragments of Greek comedy, where scholars spent their whole life collating every reference to a lost author in someone else's extant work, or every scrap of papyrus, and then they've been able to reconstruct who the person was and what the general topos or theme was of their work.
Yeah. Well, can we go back to some of the authors? I understand that Pindar was probably one of the greatest of the lyric authors, and I was wondering what you knew on his work.
He's one of the most difficult authors to read in Greek, and he has a Pindaric meter that's very difficult, but he was an Epinesian author, and that meant he wrote by commission odes or triumphalist celebrations of the winners of the Panhellenic Games. So remember how those work. There was a Super Bowl at Olympia every 4 years, and there was a playoff bowl, if I'm just being facetious, at Delphi for the Delphic Games for Apollo, in honor of Apollo at Delphi, and then Olympian Zeus at Olympia. But there were also, I guess you would call minor, not minor, but there were Isthmian games to Poseidon at Isthmus. That's at the Isthmus, and Isthmia is not very far from Corinth. And there was another Panhellenic game for Nemean Zeus at Nemea, not too far from Corinth. And so when you put those 4 Panhellenic sanctuaries and their games on a calendar, it was... You go to Olympia, and then you go to Nemea. And then second year, you get to go to Delphi. And then the third year, you go to Isthmia. And then it's Olympia again. So there was each year there was a Panhellenic festival and games. And people who won the chariot race, who won the wrestling, then would commission a poem in honor of them to celebrate, sort of like you win the Olympics today and you get media coverage. And Pindar was one of these authors, not all of his work, but he wrote about Nemean and Olympian victors and how strong they were, beautiful, something. They're very, very hard to read.
Yeah.
But he's considered, of all of the lyric poets, probably the master of meter, style, imagery, vocabulary. But he's also the most difficult. I think if you were going to start to read them in English, it would be the easiest are Simonides and Archilochus. If you want to read Tartaeus, he's a Spartan war poet, and he's very valuable to... he wrote 2 long poems, and we know a lot of information about hoplites, that is, infantrymen, how they fought from his language, because they're odes to Spartan courage. He was a Laconian. And we have Alkman, who wrote a lot about bridal songs, virgin songs about the virgin brides. He wrote, and Anacreon wrote about drinking. And so there's a whole corpus of them. And I think everybody would enjoy reading them. Next time we come at the same time, remember, we're still in the early city-state. City-state were these 1,500, what we call polises, or polis in Greek, that sprouted up after the Dark Ages that gave us Western civilization. This is the beginning. It wasn't in the Dark Ages. It wasn't during the Mycenaean period. It wasn't during the Minoan period. It was only around 700 that suddenly the Dark Ages ended. You started to get constitutional government. Writing reappeared, but with a Phoenician alpha, beta, gamma alphabet. You started to get Panhellenic sanctuaries, monumental temple building, Western civilization at the beginning, and that's when literature really starts, and it starts to be written down. And the two first genres are lyric poetry and pre-Socratic philosophy before Socrates. And it's not about ethics or human interaction, but about cosmology and natural science. So we'll talk a little bit next time about Empedocles, or Anaximander, or Thales, and what they did. And they tended to be on the coast of Turkey, the Ionian philosophers.
Yeah. Well, Victor, let's go ahead and take a break and come back and talk a little bit about the Supreme Court of the United States. Stay with us, and we'll be back.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
We're back. Victor's podcast is presented by John Solomon's Just the News, so we highly recommend John Solomon. He is an investigative reporter, and Just the News is his website with all the news on it, so it's a great source to go to for current events and things that have had investigation. So, Victor, I was just looking at a article by one of your colleagues, not at the Hoover, but at American Greatness, Julie Kelly, or she was a colleague at American Greatness. She now writes on Substack, Julie Kelly, and she was reviewing all of the cases that had to do with the election before the Supreme Court of the United States. And she came to the conclusion, looking at all that Jack Smith and the other prosecutors have put up and that needs to be addressed by the Supreme Court, presidential immunity, which Donald Trump is, I don't want to say claiming, but he's using as part of his defense, charges against the January 6th people, Colorado taking Trump off the ballot. So those are some of the cases that the Supreme Court is going to weigh in on. And she came to the conclusion that she thinks the Supreme Court, I think there were about six different issues they would have to, would be try to be impartial and would give Trump some opinions, would go Trump's way, and some opinions would go on in the direction of the prosecutors. But my understanding of those cases and the issues that she brought forward are just how bogus they are against Trump. So I thought that was an interesting take on the Supreme Court. Do you think that they would try to appear impartial, or are they going to try to do justice?
Let's start with a one unifying theme that ties these disparate cases of Alvin Bragg in New York, Fannie Willis in Atlanta, Jack Smith, Southern Florida, and Letitia James in Washington. none of them would have been lodged against Donald Trump as if, say, in January of 2021, he said, you know what, I'm 74 years old, I'm just not going to run again. That they wouldn't have been there, number one. Number two, every single one of these indictments, whether it was presidential papers or whether it was saying, you know, protest at the Capitol, even though he said to do it peacefully, compare that with what Kamala Harris said, say, in June of 2020, these demonstrations, they were violent, right? I know the fact checkers left wing say, well, she wasn't referring to the violent members, but they were all violent, basically. But these are not going to end. They're not going to end. They should not end. They're going to go on, I warn you, all the way bailing out people. Okay. So my point is, they're all applicable. If you think that Mar-a-Lago is a sloppy place for a president who has a right to declassify them had he done it formally versus Joe Biden's Corvette garage when he's vice president with no such authority and he kept papers out, and like Claudine Gay, he was reactive. He never told us until he sicked Merrick Garland, sicked the FBI and Donald Trump, and somebody said, hey, wait a minute. How about Joe? Don't you remember those papers he had in his office at University of Penn when he got that bogus, huge salary for doing nothing? Maybe he had some at home. Check. Oh, my God, he's checked. Call the FBI. And they did. And then they said, call CNN and say, unlike Donald Trump, Joe Biden warned everybody that proactive that he might be in violation. He only did it because he'd already gone after Trump and he was afraid of the hypocrisy if they found out that he'd taken out far more. So my point is this, that there was exposure on every single one of these things. Election denialism, we've gone through that, what Hillary said and what Stacey Abrams said and what Barbara Boxer said. We know what they've said and what they've done. We've known about presidential papers. We've known about non-disclosure, campaign finance. They just said to Sam Bankman-Fried, we're going to drop six major felony counts about campaign finance violations. This is the guy that was the second largest contributor to the party that is now running the DOJ. You think after you do that, that Alvin Bragg has any credibility by saying a non-disclosure form with a stripper named Stormy Daniels is a violation of campaign finance reform? So my point is that they're all bogus. They would never have been applied to Trump had he just not run for president. They would have never been applied to people who of similar or more egregious exposure if they were on the Democratic side. Okay, Sammy, what are they? They are purely political. And because they're political, they depend on politics. And because they depend on politics, they depend on the mood of the country. And what the left does not understand is that inch by inch, foot by foot, they are walking into a abyss. Because when you start indicting him for crimes that everybody knows are political and are not applicable to people with just as much criminal exposure, and then you go beyond that and you start trying to get him off the ballot in Colorado, or you try to remove the leading primary and general election candidate off the ballot on the premise that he is guilty of a crime which you have never charged him with, much less has he ever been convicted under a statute that was applied apparently not to a president, but other offices, and more importantly, had a specific Civil War context to it. If you're that desperate, you're starting to, in a political sense, turn off independents and some Democrats. And some, you mentioned earlier that African Americans and Hispanics were starting to poll maybe somewhat sympathetic in a way not true of 2020 to Donald Trump. Part of that is not just the economy, but they're tired of this. Everybody is. And so the more that they do this, then what are they else? What else do they do? They start attacking Donald Trump as a dictator who will have one last election and that's it. In other words, they're projecting upon him what they would do if they were Donald Trump and they had suffered what they have inflicted on him, then they would do certain things. But there's no evidence that Trump would do it. But my point is that they're getting people angry. And now it's a political arena. And if Donald Trump is ahead of Joe Biden, and he's way ahead on the issues, and these are political machinations, then the public either will do one of two things. If the jury, even in these left-wing cities, are made up out of these people, and there's one or two in these criminal cases that say, nope, I'm just not going to vote guilty, then they will be hung juries. Or, more importantly, if it's sort of like what Colin Gay did to the presidency of Harvard. You think from now on, if somebody is on Face the Nation or Meet the Press or Sunday Talk, no, hello, I'm Jim Smith, president of Harvard, doesn't mean anything anymore, does it? First thing people are going to say, well, do you plagiarize? Did you ever write a book? Do you allow people to go push Jews on campus or call them, you know, that you want to kill them all? Do you do that? That's what these trials have done. So if Donald, everybody thinks, and I thought this too, and I've said this on this podcast, I don't know how he's going to get out of it. But I don't know if he needs to get out of it. In other words, if he's convicted by these people, it's not going to mean anything. It's just going to be, he has a felony, so what? Does it ever say that a felon can't be president? Maybe he can run the president's out of Leavenworth. Who knows? No, I'm serious.
I know you are.
So there's nothing in the Constitution that's, you know, you've got to be 35, you've got to be a native-born citizen, you got to be in the United States, I think, the last 15 years before you run. That's about it. Doesn't say anything you can't be a felon. And does it mean that it's shameful? As all these left-wing op-eds, they all write this. Once he's convicted, it's just so shameful, he'll be done. Well, no, you're shameful for doing it. You're the ones that the shame is starting to boomerang back on, not Trump. He's going up in the polls the more you do it. You're making him into sort of a martyr. And he will relish that role, believe me, because almost every day he says, this isn't about me, it's about you, meaning my people that you're going after. So I think he's going to be tied up. I don't think they have a strategy to deal with the time and money that will be lost. The Trump people are not sure what's going to happen. But I think they're increasingly confident that the Democrats have so much legal exposure with the Biden corrupt syndicate and so much political fallout because of the unpopular agenda and so much anger at Joe Biden's cognitive state and what they passed off on us as a president who was just a facsimile or a puppet for these Obama puppeteers, that it's not going to matter. They're just going to say, you know what? I don't care anymore. If you think, oh, we can't have a president that was convicted of a felony, then people are going to say, well, we can't have a country where you indict the person on an ancient statute without ever charging him with a crime that you're disqualifying him from the ballot. I don't think they understand what they're doing to the country and to themselves. They're destroying every standard, and they're going to need those standards to retain credibility and to protect themselves. Yeah. It's like the third book of Thucydides' history about the stasis at Corcyra. When the left went after the right, the oligarchs went after the Democrats, and in the process they destroyed the idea you don't kill your opposition, you don't use a law and make a law against somebody, you don't harm their family, and all of a sudden they destroyed that. And then he makes a very brilliant comment. He said, in this hyper-polarized climate, people did not understand that when they destroyed the institutional protections of the citizen, that they themselves, the perpetrators, might have a need to have a refuge or sanctuary within them. And that's what the left doesn't understand.
Yeah.
Once you set the precedent that you can take a candidate off the ballot, well, then Joe Biden may be taken off of, I don't know, Mississippi or Idaho's because he has failed to enforce the laws on the border, or he's a crook. You don't have to. And you're going to say, Sammy's going to say, well, how do you know he's a crook? I know he's a crook as much as I know that Donald Trump is guilty of insurrection. He's never been charged with it. No, formally. He's never been convicted. And guess what? You don't have to be anymore in the new Biden world. And that's what they've done. They've destroyed our reputation as a country. They've destroyed our moral high ground to lecture other countries. And they're going to find that all the things that they have done, first term impeachment, impeachment without a special counsel's report, collusion, 22 months of a hoax to destroy a president, hiring a foreign national to compile lies about your political opponent in a presidential election, impeaching somebody by leaking a phone call that was supposed to be confidential from the national security staff over a request that you not have bribery as a condition to get expedited foreign aid, not canceling it, just we're going to hold off until you prove you're not crooked anymore. All of those things. 51 intelligence authorities who lied and said this information on a laptop is Russian. All of that comes back at them.
Yeah.
They have no moral credibility. And so they think that, oh, wow, we're going to embarrass the right. We're going to do all this to Donald Trump. All they're doing is destroying the institutions. And they're discrediting the institutions, they're discrediting themselves, they're discrediting the country, and there's a huge, you know,
backlash coming.
I think a lot of it is, this is a very controversial statement when you said earlier that you quoted a 65% only Biden margin among African Americans.
Yes. 63% for Biden.
Yes. I think a lot of that is the economy and things. And I think they look back as everybody does and looks at Trump. But I think there's a lot of people in the black community that they look at Fannie Willis in Georgia and they look at Alvin Bragg in New York and they look at Letitia James and they look at all of these prosecutors who are black women in these cities and they say, you know what? That's not us. We don't do that. These people have gone completely crazy. They're going after Donald Trump. And he did more for our community than Biden's done. And you're going after him and you're representing us, supposedly, because you keep saying that he's racist. And yet you're attacking somebody on something that's entirely political. And we're not going to have any solidarity with you. And when you add in the whole idea of Trump as a victim and the mugshot and all that stuff, I don't think they understand what they're doing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's sort of the same. It's parallel or it's a mirror image of the white community when you're a white working class person and you see on TV all of these elites and they get on TV and they're in universities and they tisk and they give all these lectures and then people say white privilege and white. And you think, wait a minute, those people don't represent me. I'm a working class guy. I don't have anything to do with these academics or these techies or these Hollywood people or these foundational people or anybody that's in these entertainment, late night comedy. I don't like those people. And just because we look the same doesn't mean they speak. In fact, it makes you angrier.
Yeah.
And you say, I don't want to, whatever they're for, I'm against. And I think there's some people in the black community that have the same idea, that these people keep saying they're black or they're calling people racist, and they think, you know what? You don't speak for me. I don't find him racist. I find him on inflation and jobs and crime pretty good. As far as I was concerned, that's what they think.
Yeah.
And they think I don't have the money as Manal Sharpton, or I don't have the prestige of Claudine Gay, or I don't have the security of Oprah or the Obamas. So what they think doesn't necessarily represent me. I think there's what I'm getting at is I think there's the DEI is starting to wane and class is starting to come back. Yeah. And a lot of people saying, I'm not going to just be expressing solidarity on the basis of race anymore. Starting to.
Yeah. Well, I hope you're right in this election. I think that the Democrats are banking on they can create enough noise and fanfare with these trials that it will get them the margin. And I hope that's wrong. And I hope that your assessment of the polls or the people is much more accurate.
I'm skeptical of polls, and I, as I said earlier in an earlier broadcast, I don't believe that there's really 65% of blacks are going to vote for Biden and 35% are going to vote for Trump. But I'm not saying that that doesn't represent a trend.
Yeah.
And the trend, as I said, it could be 15 or 20, which would be enough to hurt Biden to a degree he wouldn't be elected. But I think there is something going on. And I think October 7th was something, the December 5th testimony of those college presidents, the resignation of Gay at Harvard. I think the left and the polls of all the polls show that for all of the... You know what's weird when they say Donald Trump is only... I've heard this on TV and I've heard people say it to me. Donald Trump is only ahead by 2 or 3 points. Only ahead by 2 or 3 points. Can you believe it? Why should I vote for him? Or he's ahead by 2 or 3 points in a context of having the most one-sided, vicious media against him than anybody. After 2 impeachments, after all of these disinformation, collusion, after all the stories about his family, his wife, himself, Stormy, all of that, how in the world could he be 2 points ahead of Joe Biden? And he's more than that in swing states.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. We'll see, because, you know, I think Haley and DeSantis have viable strategies. They think, well, you know, we can't really campaign against Trump because we agree with him on almost everything. And we want him to debate. That's something that he won't debate us. So that's an issue. And the other issue is going to be tied up in court. And that's their strategy. And it may work. But so far, the polls suggest that each time the left overreaches, there's an advantage Trump. We'll see if there's on these podcasts, I've tried to give both sides. And one side is that finally the Republican or conservative voter gets in a fetal position, puts his hands over his ears, says, I can't take it anymore. I can't take it. Donald Trump, just, I like him. I voted for him, but I don't want him because they all go crazy over him and they put him in jail. I want to get somebody different. Or it's screw you. Go ahead and do your worst and we'll do our best and may the best person win. I hope you try to get him in 20 courts. It doesn't mean blank to us. And there's, you know, one of defiance and one of weariness.
Yeah.
And I think there's both out there, and I don't know which is going to be the predominant feeling among the electorate on the conservative side.
Well, Victor, we're at a hard end to this show. I know you have things to do, so we are ending it right here. We thank all of our listeners. We appreciate you.
Wait. You didn't ask me the $64,000 question.
Which was, what side are you on? I know what side you're on.
No. What is the status of the Echo Diesel?
Oh, yes. What is that status?
I have an update every week. I go from, I'm like the Athenians watching the sea battle at Syracuse, where Thucydides says, they were screaming and yelling and happy, and then they were depressed. And then they were happy as they saw a trireme either sink or sink someone else. They were on the shore. I'm on the shore looking at this. I got a little email again, and it said, we have approved, again, your repurchase of your truck. And I wrote back and said, but you've said that now 3 times, and you're turning me over to a repurchasing agent. But I haven't seen the repurchasing agent, and I haven't seen the certificate. You said that I could get a discount because I got a lemon that doesn't run. And then in the midst of that, after calling on October 1st, being admitted to the dealer shop mid-October, all of October then, all of November, all of December, I got a call. Victor, the part is in. Ta-da! The part is in. So now they're going to put the part into the turbo, the hose, little hose. You could probably use any little hose, but it had to be a turbo hose. In any case, they put it in once, and they put a new turbo in, and it didn't last more than 2 months. So I'm hoping that they put the turbo hose, it will last enough so I can pick it up and drive it where? to meet the mythical repurchasing agent. And where is a mythical repurchasing agent who's going to write me a check for the lemon truck? And then the question is, does it stay at the dealer? Do the dealer take possession of it so they can get a repurchase check? I don't know. I know that if I take it home and I'm driving it, they might say, well, you waited. You've had 5 months of repair wait, and now you have it, so let's just call it even. Keep driving it. No. And then I'm afraid if I drive it after they fix it and it's broken down twice, it might break down three times. And then what do I do? Because it says that the email said the truck must be in good condition, meaning the parts that you put in that were defective have to be fixed by authorized dealers that you authorize that don't have the parts because you don't have them, and therefore they have to be magically fixed and delivered to you. I don't know. But my point is, there is new news. New news in this saga is always no news
at all. Well, Victor,
I'm very relaxed about it.
New news, no news.
And what I like the most about it, I have learned from our dear listeners everything I want to know about an Echo Diesel. Director, yes. here's my take on it. Here's my experience. And they're all brilliant guys. And they know 10 times more about an Echo Diesel than I do.
Yeah.
So
it's and maybe then your mechanics do it's too.
I'm afraid so. There was one wonderful guy, I won't mention his name there, that he called. He's a really good guy.
He's trying very hard.
He feels terrible about it. And he calls me about every 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And even though nothing happens, he's concerned that nothing happened.
Yeah.
So,
all right.
Okay.
Well, Victor, that's the end of the show. Thank you to our listeners, and thank you to all, especially the discussion of lyric poetry. I had no idea its importance in Western civilization.
Very important, especially for English lyric poetry.
Yeah. Well, thank you, and thanks to the listeners.
Thank you, everybody, for listening.
This is Sammy Wink and Victor Davis Hanson, and we're signing off.